Hi, everyone. Healthcare in the U.S. can look vastly different depending on where you live, what your financial state is, whether you're employed, and more, including what the color of your skin is. People of color in the U.S. generally have less access to healthcare and die more frequently of preventable diseases. The reasons for this are mired in the complex social and political history of our young country, from slavery to civil rights to redlining to broad divestment in communities of color. I cannot begin to do this massive topic justice with my few podcast episodes, but hopefully I can open some eyes and broaden some views to the current state of health inequities here in the U.S. and how we got here. Over the next few episodes, we'll hear from people that research these disparities, people who are living it, and hear about some of the solutions being implemented to combat it. This is Dr. Patient, a podcast that examines all the aspects of the patient-provider relationship. I'm your host, Heather Johnston, MD, a real-life doctor and patient. My guest today is Linda Villarosa, an author on race and health in America, a professor and journalist in residence at the City College of New York, a contributing writer to the New York Times, and a contributor to the 1619 Project. She's written a few books. Her latest that came out in 2022 is Under the Skin, The Hidden Toll of Racism on American Lives and on the Health of Our Nation. It was a Pulitzer Prize finalist. It was named one of the top 10 essential books of 2022 by the New York Times, and it was named one of the 100 must-read books of 2022 by Life magazine, and I could not agree more. I found it riveting and perfectly balanced between anecdotes, history, and data, and I just couldn't put it down. Last year, she and I discussed her book to better understand how we got to where we are today in terms of racial disparities in healthcare in the U.S. Here's my guest, Linda Villarosa.
Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. Can you talk a little bit about the book?
Yes. Well, first, thank you for having me. The book looks at sort of the myth that racial health disparities, which have always been a part of our country, there's never been a time when Black people and white people and often other people of color were equal. And but usually the idea is that it's our fault. As Black people, we're doing something wrong or something is wrong with our bodies. And my bigger point of the book is that no, instead of looking at race as a public health crisis or public health threat or a way to explain these racial health disparities, I ask to look at racism or the toll it takes on our bodies and on our lives to just be discriminated against and treated badly in America over centuries.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the data that you present. Data is incredibly important. I loved the comment by Dr. Carol Hogue, an epidemiologist at Emory, when she said, "No one believes you unless you really have evidence behind it. You can't just explain what you know. You have to prove it over and over." And I believe that too in this topic. You cataloged a lot of evidence in this book. I'd like to read a few of the most shocking current realities out loud to set the stage for those listening who might not otherwise realize where things are at with health disparities in the U.S. today.
The book lays out in shocking clarity some of the myths about Black bodies that have persisted and are still believed by many in healthcare today. We're going to go into a couple of these in more depth in a little bit, and I'll reference the corresponding research studies that prove these in the show notes. But first, Black women in the U.S. have a significantly higher death rate during pregnancy than white women. Second, there have been a lot of studies showing that Black patients receive pain medication less often and in lesser quantities compared to white patients. One study out of the University of Virginia in 2016 found that up to half of white medical students interviewed believed one or more myths about Black bodies, and this correlated with a racial bias in understanding pain perception and prescribing treatment. Third, there's what's called a race correction on a medical test performed to evaluate lung function. Basically, people of color are given a different threshold of what constitutes normal lung function compared with white people. This leads to a large number of people of color who are diagnosed with normal lung function who, in fact, have low or abnormal lung function. The need for this correction is not actually rooted in any hard science, And there's even evidence to the contrary that it should no longer be used, but is still happening sometimes in the U.S.
I think that the one about the medical students and pain is the hardest to read. And what makes that one worse is that many of those myths around the thickness of skin or pain tolerance, that Black people have superhuman tolerance to pain, are difficult to believe because they were grounded in enslavement. And they began pushed by white physicians, white Southern physicians and scientists who had something to gain from this.
Who were largely slave owners.
Who were often slave owners and had, so they were trying to justify enslavement and all the cruelty that went with it. So the fact that so many medical students who are the doctors to be still believe these facts is shocking. I think the one about maternal mortality is also difficult because there's always the assumption that if you lose your life as a result of being pregnant or having a baby, then, the idea is that behind it is that there's something you did wrong or that you're uneducated or you didn't know the right thing or you had no access to healthcare. But actually, it's a Black woman with a master's degree, a PhD, a JD, or an MD is more likely to die or almost die than a white woman with only an eighth grade education. So that says if education is a proxy for the things that should make you healthy, then that is scary. And also the fact that the disparity is greater at the higher levels of education. So, if the only difference is your race and not your access to education, healthcare, money, a good doctor, then something's really wrong in this country.
Yeah, I think it's important to dispel that huge false premise that the disparities are caused by poverty or lack of education, which is still touted really by a lot in the medical community today, even though there's very clear evidence and research and data to show that that's not the fact.
And I really also want to point out that, people who are living at or under the poverty line do have a much harder time in America. But the problem is that's not the only explanation. And the reason I'm so adamant about this is I know that if your explanation is wrong, your solution will always be wrong.
Yes, excellent point. Do you think you could talk for a couple of minutes of some of the practices that are happening today and the beliefs that are happening today that are rooted in the evil Dr. Cartwright? Or Dr. Sims, could you talk about one or both of them and how that happened from what they learned and what their experiments were to how it impacts today?
Dr. J. Marion Sims was a physician, highly trained physician who mostly practiced in Montgomery, Alabama in the 1800s. And he was an OBGYN. He's largely until recently considered the father of gynecology. And people use the Sims speculum apparently, and still. And he was doing experiments on enslaved women to perfect a procedure that would cure fistula, which is an extreme side effect of childbirth. And he had three main enslaved women, Anarka, Betsy, and Lucy. And the three of them were his, guinea pigs. And he practiced, over and over again, often in public, in front of a sort of a public forum of doctors to perfect this surgery. And there was no anesthesia at the time. Later, when there was anesthesia, he didn't use it on the enslaved women. And more recently, people have looked back at his practices, which he detailed in his book, My Life, which I read, and he talks about the extreme pain the women were in, and in a way that was just very casual, because he was operating under the assumption that Black people don't feel the same amount of pain, that Black people are somehow numb to pain. The interesting thing recently is that there were statues of him around the country because of his, the father of gynecology, including one in New York. The New York one, after sustained protests by people often wearing gowns stained with blood red paint to signify the enslaved women, his statue was taken down in New York City and removed. Yeah. It was not removed in Montgomery, Alabama, where he mostly did his work. But there is a counter sort of protest, I guess you'd call it, of an art installation with bigger than life size statues of Betsy, Anarka, and Lucy. The other thing that is very cool is there's a book coming out next year called Say Anarka, and it's about her life, where there's a historian who really tracked down everything about her, including where she was buried. It was hard to find her because even after Dr. Sims, her body was traded by her owner back and forth, and it was hard to keep track of her children, who she married. But this researcher found the information, and the book will be out next year.
Wonderful. Wonderful. How about Dr. Cartwright?
Dr. Cartwright was another highly praised physician, again, in that same time period during enslavement, practicing out of Louisiana. And the thing about Dr. Cartwright was he wrote in medical journals. He was published, you know, in mainstream press. He was presented proceedings at medical conferences. And he was considered a, you know, one of the foremost experts in so-called Negro diseases. But he was also a white Southern physician who owned enslaved people. And the main thing that he said was that Black people have lower lung function. Something's wrong with Black people's lungs, which could be strengthened by working in the fields. He also had a very strange mental health issue that he said Black people had called drapetomania. And drapetomania created the urge to escape, and that it could be solved by, yes, escape enslavement. Yes. And that beating people would beat it out of them. And the through line to Dr. Cartwright is he used something called a spirometer to measure lung function. And his spirometer that he was using back then, it was sort of an archaic kind of thing. There was a race correction baked into it that made the assumption that Black people had lower lung function, 10 to 15%. Fast forward to today, and the modern spirometer still often, there's a switch on the side, and you can switch and make a race correction that has the same race correction that kind of insane Dr. Cartwright was talking about centuries ago.
I'm going to interject here an interesting note about the spirometer. It's basically a tube that a patient breathes into while sitting in a special enclosed chamber, and it measures overall lung function. After I interviewed Linda, I called the spirometry department of one of the hospitals here in Chicago, and I talked to the technician and asked him about this, and he said that the switch is still there, and he is still instructed to flip it for patients of color. To date, there have been handfuls of studies that have proven that there is simply no science behind this practice, and yet it still persists. Just saying, this is 100 years later.
I think the other thing that when you're looking at these sort of genetic issues or, you know, that sort of something is wrong with or inferior about or different about Black bodies versus white bodies or bodies, other bodies of color, you don't look at other structural issues outside of the doctor's office, including that Black people are more likely to live adjacent to pollution, including air pollution. So that could have a factor about the lungs and should be definitely asked about rather than to just assume that something is inherently different or wrong with Black people's bodies.
Can you discuss weathering?
Weathering is a concept coined by Dr. Arlene Geronimus, who is a professor at the University of Michigan. And she's been studying this for decades. And what she found is that people who have to fight against daily and, you know, frequent insults and instances of discrimination, including racism, it changes the systems of their body. And it creates a kind of accelerated aging, which she called weathering. And for her, weathering had a dual kind of meaning. One, it's that the same way a house is weathered by a storm, is weathered by bad weather, the shingles get chipped, the paint's knocked off, the windows break. But also people that are treated badly have community and have resilience. We weather the storm. And Dr. Geronimus's research became super important during the COVID-19 outbreak because you saw, especially at the beginning, Black people as a demographic had earlier poor health outcomes, younger poor health outcomes than white people. So mm-hmm. Black people had the worst health outcomes between, say, 50 and 60. White people's didn't come later till 60 and 70. And so that was showing, it, because this looked like it was connected to age, and it still may be, that you know, Black people may be aging prematurely, and that was causing these worse health outcomes. So in there's been times in the past when Dr. Geronimus's research was not believed. And what she did was got more and more and more rigorous. I'm really excited for her because she has a book coming out called Weathering. I've read it like three times. I'm super excited by, you know, to see her finally getting lifted up in the way she deserves, and to see that people are taking her, the concept of weathering, very seriously.
Yeah, I was not surprised to read in several of your chapters how much people do not want to believe some of the outcomes that are being shown in the studies that we're mentioning.
And that's why people like Dr. Geronimus stick with it. Yeah. Another person who has been doing this for decades is Dr. David Williams. He is a professor at the Harvard School of Public Health, really smart person. But if you look through, he's like Carol Hogue, where they just keep doing these studies to prove that this is real, that racial health disparities are not the fault of the people that are suffering from them. And what he does is he has like a one huge study almost every year. And so I always read his studies because they're so well done and they're so comprehensive. And then if you look at the footnotes of his studies are often his other studies, because they're all, he's just trying to prove that this is true. And he's trying to prove for decades. And what I like is that now there's a greater acceptance that this is real, that there is a problem of America that's harming people who are treated poorly.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about advocacy as part of our move towards a larger conversation about solutions. Reading about the lengths that you and your family had to go through when your dad was in the hospital to help the staff there see him as more than his age or the color of his skin, I thought a lot about the patient advocacy movement that's happening in general. You know, companies and services and groups are popping up all over the place to help patients navigate the system, because it's so broken and complex and difficult for anybody to be a part of. But I wondered, I noticed that most of them do not mention any particular expertise in helping patients who are people of color. I wondered if you knew of any or what your thoughts are about that.
Well, I'm really excited by that movement. I think the thing that makes me the happiest is when you look at what's going on with community health workers. Mm-hmm. And community health workers are a broad term that is more, you know, more employed overseas in countries much less wealthy than ours. And it's people who come from the communities that they are serving, mm-hmm. and often have had dealings with the health problem that, you know, they're trying to work with the patient with. And so it's connecting this caring person who has some experience and often has something in common with the patient, with that person, to help them navigate the system. And unfortunately, in our country, it's not as systematized and institutionalized as it is in other countries like Brazil or India or some African countries. But mm-hmm. I think that movement is really important. And I think it's important in this country to get it systematized. People like this can be called doulas. They can maybe be called community health workers, patient navigators. There's all kind of different names for them. I think mm-hmm. if we understood and institutionalized it and valued them and paid them for what they were worth, that would be really helpful. And many of the solutions that we have are not part, you know, it's sort of piecemeal and kind of like it relies on someone being caring or someone funding it. And we have to make sure that this is part of our government system or our hospital or medical systems, so that it's just taken for granted that this is going to be part of it. Instead, we throw people to the mercy of our healthcare system, which is broken, under the assumption that, oh, they have access to the wealthiest country in America, in the world. They have access to the most high tech and, you know, advanced and sophisticated technology. But that isn't always the case if it's cold, if, you know, it's discriminatory, and if people are afraid of it.
Gosh, you know, the system is, the healthcare system today is so wrapped around the idea of just business, money changing hands. And it's so difficult to get systems to cover programs that just simply benefit people who need help.
I think that's difficult. And, you know, I mean, our system, the reason one, it doesn't work is because it's wrapped in capitalism, because you have to pay for something that should be a right. But yes, even if we had, you know, healthcare for all, we still, unless we examine the system the way it is and fix it, then we're still going to have these kind of racial health disparities that are really clear and have surfaced even more, obviously, recently.
All right, let's talk a little bit about hope for the future. I need some hope. I need hope and positivity right now. In your chapter on solutions, you outline a few things that people are doing to increase awareness of the problem, how to make it better. Ideas like grassroots organizations, patient advocacy models, community health workers, as you were just discussing, the need for more research and data, a la Dr. Hogue, some anti-bias training and medical student training. Do you have a feeling about some of these working better than others?
I'm really excited about the model in California, where their rates of maternal mortality several years ago were exactly the same as the country, which means high, rising, unequal. Black women 3 to 4 times more likely to die or almost die. And what they did was they fixed the system at the hospital level. So they said, if there's a emergency C-section or if a woman is hemorrhaging, then here are all the tools that are necessary and here are the instructions of what to do so that everyone involved had the same model. And then they tested it over several years and found out that because of just those fixes, the number of women who died in related to childbirth dropped 55%. However, the racial health disparity didn't change. So what they did was say, we have mandate now by law that anyone who works with a birthing person must go through some kind of anti-implicit bias training. They had to. And it unfortunately, it happened in 2019 and then 2020 came. So we haven't gotten a good look at what's going on in California. I went to Louisiana during the pandemic and their model, you know, they have even higher rates of maternal and infant mortality. And they started right away. They didn't make the mistake that California did. They started right away with their implicit bias training. And they said it's got to be pretty robust training. Again, we're not sure exactly what happened because once the pandemic came in, then it made the honestly, maternal infant mortality worse. So now you can't tell if fixing that system helped. So I think that other states following the model of California, but earlier, and Louisiana is really important. And that's a really positive, that's very positive. Again, we have the Momnibus Bill. So the Momnibus Bill is to fight maternal mortality. It also has some kind of anti-racism bias training, anti-racism training in it, but it hasn't passed yet. So it keeps getting introduced, but it doesn't pass. So that is really good that we have this legislation that can make a difference nationally. But it's not great if it keeps being introduced and it never quite, you know, we never quite pull the trigger, I guess you'd say, in the country.
Please remind me, was the California movement, do you think, linked in any way to what happened in New York with the with Dr. Bassett that you wrote about in your book, where she had mandated anti-bias training for everyone that works in the health department there?
I'm not sure if it was connected implicitly, or I'm not sure if it was connected explicitly to her, but the thing she did is several years ago in the New England Journal of Medicine, she wrote an essay that said it was very strong. It was like a, you know, like a call to action for all physicians to, if you're going to treat Black patients, you have to also fight against anti-Black racism. She said, you can't do one without the other. And yeah. I think her advocacy is really important. She used to be the head of the New York City Health Department, and now she's the head of the New York State Health Department. So yeah. she has an even larger platform. So I think that's very important. She's also connected with the Harvard School of Public Health. So all those connections to her are important, but I'm not sure, you know, if what she did in New York was exactly tied to what happened in California.
Mm-hmm. We actually just had something related to that happen here in Chicago in the last couple of years. We had a recycling plant called General Iron here in Chicago. It actually is right in my neighborhood. And it was shown by the EPA to be putting off terrible amounts of pollution. The community was up in a huge uproar about it. The city aldermen all got involved, and they tried to move it to the to a part of the city that was largely minority. And I think they thought they could just slide it through. And there were humongous protests all over the city about it. And our mayor, Lori Lightfoot, got involved and ended up, they rescinded their license to relocate to that place. I don't know what they're doing now. I think they tried to move back here, and I'm not sure where things are at right now. They can't really move anywhere, but I'm glad people stood up, because the idea was just go put it in that other neighborhood.
I really like that story. And I think it's important when we're talking about solutions and we're talking about sort of forward movement, that activism is part of it. And certainly in the environmental justice movement, which began as a largely Black movement, has ticked up. And one of the most positive things I've seen is something called Lightly Black and Green. And that is the sort of movement at historically Black colleges and universities for students to get involved in environmental justice, because many of them are located in the South where the problem is worse.
Yeah. Yeah.
The only thing I wanted to add was the reason this issue is so important, beyond just sort of from a human perspective, that Black people shouldn't be suffering under the weight of our healthcare system and our society, is that these kinds of problems that we have in America have dragged down our health outcomes as a country compared mm-hmm. to other wealthy countries. So it really doesn't make any sense why we would have the best medical technology and clinical innovations. Why would be the richest country in America? Why we would be the richest country in the world and spend more on healthcare than any place else? And part of the reason is because we lack universal access to healthcare. But the other part of the equation is that we have so much discrimination and ill treatment in our society and in our systems that it's really making a mark on our country internationally. So I think in my book, one thing I say is this is an American problem mm-hmm. and it needs an American solution. And sometimes the best solutions are those that have come from poorer countries, like community health workers. If they are more organized in Africa, Brazil, India, places that are much less wealthy than ours, we need to pay attention, not just export our expertise out of the country, mm-hmm. but also import their expertise into our country and use ideas that have already been accepted and successful in other places, and not just assume we can rely on technology and so-called doctor our way out of these problems, and look at other ways of solving the issues that are really causing the country as a whole a problem.
Yeah, I feel like we're so divided here today. It's hard to get even half of people to make movement in a certain direction. And when you do, I feel like the other half are right there putting up walls.
And, you know, what's really hard about that is some of the people who are treated the worst are poor white people in places like Kentucky, West Virginia, mm-hmm. where I went for my book, and Arkansas, places like that, and not even all in the South. But anyone who is discriminated against, anyone who is treated badly, anyone who has to, suffer in our country and is treated like it's their fault, that is going to have an effect on their bodies. And if they're living in places that have, been erased, like much of the South has, or that have, there's no investment in those places anymore, it's going to have an effect on their health. And what we know best about is the health of Black people, because we've been looking at it forever. And we've been looking at it since 1619 because our bodies were worth something. They were commodified. So there was a, you know, there was a reason to try to study our health and to figure out ways to keep us healthy. Then that reason went away after, you know, slavery was abolished. But, you know, still the problems persist. So I think this is an interesting question, that this is a question about America. It's been, it's most obvious in Black people and often other people of color, but it's a national issue.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. What should the average patient do?
I think that unfortunately you do have to be hypervigilant in the, you know, when you enter the healthcare system. The best thing you can do is take good care of yourself so you have less contact with the healthcare system, which, you know, it's hard for everyone. So do the things you're supposed to do. And then if you have to enter the healthcare system, take an advocate, take someone with you. I'm everybody's advocate in my family. And if I go in for something that I'm a little afraid of, I will take someone. I will call my physician and midwife and nurse practitioner friends to say, what are the questions I should ask? And that's just a smart way to, you know, for anyone, but especially for a healthcare system that may treat you unfairly.
I could not agree more strongly. I also act as the advocate to everyone we know. My brother is also a physician. He's going to retire soon. I am currently retired. And we have joked that we should start a pro bono company called Your Doctor Friend and just offer to go with people to appointments.
Because brilliant.
It's so difficult. It's so difficult for non-medical people to navigate the system today.
Really good.
It's difficult for me as an actual physician. What should the average doctor be doing?
I think the average doctor needs to be advocating for changes in medical education and training. Also to lean into the idea that this is not you being called racist, but this is you saying this should be part of my continuing medical education to just make sure that I understand, you know, my own, you know, issues in with race or with difference. And then figure out how to attack it, because don't, you know, anyone wants to be the best at their profession that they can, and including doctors. And that just should be part of it. And also to advocate in groups that, you know, like support what the AMA is doing, support groups that are pushing for universal health care, you know, do that kind of work. And, you know, like Dr. Mary Bassett says, you can't just treat Black patients and to extending that to patients of color. Or patients who are different than you, you have to advocate and push to end oppression in our country and in our systems.
Yeah. Yes, I really appreciate the work that you're doing. Really do.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you. I appreciate you.
I hope you've enjoyed today's program, as it's an introduction to the next few episodes on racial disparities in healthcare today. This topic is vast, and there are so many amazing people doing the hard work, both to bring this disheartening topic to the forefront, but also to come up with solutions to repair the damage and prevent more going forward. I've put many, many resources in the show notes for today's episode, but if this topic interests you, I encourage you to read more on your own, including reading Under the Skin. And please let me know of any other amazing resources that you find. Thanks for listening today. To catch up on more episodes and to get new ones delivered directly to you, subscribe wherever you find your podcasts, Apple, Google, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and more. If you'd like to be a guest or have an idea for an episode, let me know at www.drpatientpodcast.com. That's drpatientpodcast.com. Here's the disclaimer. Even though I am a doctor, I'm not your doctor. These stories, my comments, and all discussion is purely reflection about what's working in the healthcare system and what isn't. Don't use any medical information that you hear in these episodes to diagnose or treat yourself. If you have a question about your health, get in touch with your doctor or local health clinic.